Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
My sense has always been that, you know, something happened to him. I don't think he abandoned his bike and took off for another life. You know, there's some people that are really independent and, you know, they could go off on their own tomorrow and be perfectly fine. He was not that person. We were close, and there's no way anybody could convince me that he would just take off and start a new life without, you know, reaching out. I just don't believe it. I think something happened to him there. You could write, you know, 20 different novels making up different scenarios and endings, but I guess the bottom line in my mind is that he wasn't the kind of independent person that could get a whole new identity and go on his merry way. There's really no reason that he would even want to. He certainly wasn't, he didn't have any kind of criminal record or anything like that. He wasn't running from anybody. He was just kind of a naive kid, you know, really. I know he was 19 going on 20, but some people just don't mature as quickly as others, and he was definitely one of them, I thought.
In August of 1985, 19-year-old David Lovely and his family were moving from their home in California to the opposite side of the country in Massachusetts. David's mother and sister were driving the moving truck, while David rode his maroon 1978 Yamaha motorcycle. A cross-country road trip is not a quick journey in the slightest. So every 30 miles or so, the family would stop to check on one another. During one stop in Evanston, Wyoming, David told his family he wanted to continue on, and that he would meet up with them at the next rest stop. At some point, David stopped in Fort Bridger, Wyoming, which is about a half hour away from Evanston. David called his aunt from the Bingo truck stop to tell her that his motorcycle had broken down. Apparently, another man who also had a motorcycle had helped him fix whatever the issue was. David asked his aunt to relay this message to his family when they called her at their next stop. Sadly, this would be the last time David's family would hear from him. 9 days after David mysteriously disappeared, his motorcycle was found by campers on a dirt road near Sweetwater County Airport in Rock Springs, Wyoming, which is over 70 miles from the Bingo truck stop, the place he had called his aunt from. The keys were found in the bike's ignition, and the tank was half full. The bike was also fully operational. However, there was no sign of David. Those who were closest with David say that he would never leave his family behind without a single word. So what happened to David on that August day in 1985? I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 211 of The Vanished, David Lovely's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. For this story, we were able to speak with two of David's siblings, his sisters Karen and Allison. Karen was not on the cross-country trip with David and their mother, but Allison was. Before we get into the events of August 5th, 1985, we wanted to provide a little insight into who David was as a person. Here's Karen speaking about her brother, David.
David was my younger brother.
He was really bright, really imaginative. And when he was three, he had a major health issue. He almost died from kidney failure. And he ended up that year going in for surgery, which then turned into another surgery. And he basically spent, at one point when he was younger, almost an entire year at the Mass General Hospital. And it really changed him and made him, he was already kind of introverted. And I think just learning how to self-soothe and to help with the pain and stuff like that made him, you know, like he was able to meditate before he was 10. So he was also really artistic and creative. One of my favorite David stories is there was an artist who wrote in a magazine that he really liked, and it was, I want to say it was called Omni Magazine. It was some kind of scientific sci-fi. It was really popular back in the 80s. And David was going to college then, and he recognized the artist walking across the campus and ran up to her and said, oh my gosh, you know, you're that artist. I love your work. And he was maybe like one of 100 people in the entire country who would have recognized her. And she was so thrilled, and she gave him a big hug. And that sort of really defines David, who he is, and his kind of interests and how he looked at the world. And he saw things differently from other people. He was really, really bright and very creative, you know, as an artist and as a thinker. He was a really, really cool kid. We all grew up on the East Coast, and my dad moved to California with my brothers. And then my mom decided she wanted to move to California to be closer to them. So she moved everything out to Huntington Beach.
Back in August of 1985, David's family was moving from California to Massachusetts. Here's David's sister Allison touching on why her family was making this big move.
So my parents got divorced when I was a kid, and my father had relocated to California, I think around 1980 or so, 81. David moved out there with my father and had his junior year and senior year in high school out there at Marina High School. He went to college for a semester or two and then just was working at Jack in the Box in Huntington Beach. My mom had stayed in Massachusetts after they got divorced. She decided to sell her house in West Newbury, Mass, and relocate to California. She moved out there, and I'm trying to think, it was April, I guess, of 85, and she couldn't find a job. She was renting an apartment. Her coworker flew out to visit her, like at the end of May or something, and just started dating, I guess, before she had decided to move. And so when he flew out, he proposed and said, I love you, and all this kind of stuff. So she decided in July that she was going to marry him and she was going to move back to Massachusetts because she couldn't find work and she couldn't find a good, an inexpensive place to stay, you know, without a job and stuff like that. So she asked David if he wanted to come back east with us. And he said yes, because he wasn't too thrilled with where he was living and working at Jack in the Box and stuff like that. And he wanted to go back to Massachusetts where he had friends from when he was younger. And so that's why we were all driving back east.
Karen explained how the family coordinated during their trip with David on the motorcycle and Allison and their mother in the moving van.
My sister Allison said she wanted to move back east with her, and my brother David said he wanted to move back east with her. And so what they decided to do was rent a Ryder truck and move all my mom's furniture in it, tow her pickup truck behind it. And then David had just saved up all of his money and bought a motorcycle, a Yamaha motorcycle. And that was going to be his transportation. So he wanted to drive with them on his motorcycle. And my sister and my mom were driving the Ryder truck with the pickup truck towed behind it. So David, his bike was air-cooled, and he had a really hard time staying behind them, especially because it's a moving truck with another truck in tow. So going up some of those mountains, they could only go like 40 miles an hour, and David's bike was overheating. So they came up with a new plan, which would be that they would, you know, especially with a motorcycle having such a small tank, so you have to stop far more often for gas. So they decided that what they would do is David would go ahead of them, at a faster speed, and he would stop at a rest area in, you know, like 30 miles or so. And then they would connect, and then they would go to the next stop. And that's what they would do until they decided to stop for the night. And that's exactly what had happened. And then the last rest area that they all stopped together, Allison, my sister, wanted to stop for the night. She was really tired. She hadn't slept in a couple of days. And she's only a year older than David. Keep that in mind. She was also very young. You know, Allison was 20. They were only a year apart. And instead, David turned to my mom and said, another 30 miles. And my mom said, yeah. And off they went. And when they got to the next rest area, David wasn't there. So they waited and they thought, well, that's kind of weird. He was ahead of us. So he must have gotten tired of waiting for us and he must be further up ahead. So then they went to the next rest area.
Allison, who was in the moving truck with her mother, gave us her perspective on what happened on August 5th, 1985.
So we agreed to meet in 30 miles. And the first time we met up, he just walked over to my mom's side of the window, and I think she said, oh, stop at the next rest area, because I told her I was tired. We had stayed up the night before in Vegas. David had gone to the hotel and slept, but my mom and I had stayed up because it was the first time I'd ever been there, first time she had ever been there. But anyway, I said, Mom, you know, who knows how many miles to the next rest area? Tell him, you know, 30, no more than 30 miles. And so I stuck my head out the window and started yelling toward him, but he had his helmet on. He didn't hear me. He jumped on the bike and took off. So I started driving and I went 30 miles and then 35 and 40 and no David. And so she told me that earlier that day they had lunch together and he had said he wanted to make it all the way to Cheyenne. I said, I can't drive to Cheyenne tonight. I'm exhausted. I have to stop and get some sleep. I did drive to as far as the next rest area and he wasn't there. And so I said, Mom, I think we might have passed him, you know, because the Ryder truck has two gas tanks, so I could just flip switch and keep on going. You know, obviously his motorcycle just had the one tank that only goes so far. Long story short, no David. I ended up parking on a rest area ramp. I didn't even want to pull in. I wanted him to be able to see the yellow Ryder truck if he was behind me, because I was thinking he must have stopped to get gas and we missed him. And my mother was saying, no, he kept going. He was, you know, he was excited to get back to Massachusetts. And so he didn't want to stay. So he went ahead. And I said, well, I'm just going to park on this ramp. And if he's behind us, then he'll see us. So tried to sleep, you know, that night on the side of the road in the truck. And I remember being really cold. I woke up and had to turn the truck on just to get some heat. At some point, you know, I shut it off, fell back to sleep and woke up, you know, with my teeth chattering. So I think it got down to like the high 40s, low 50s that night. The next day, I said, we need to go to the police and report him missing or something, Mom, or start trying to find him because, you know, I don't know what to do. I think he's behind us. And she's like, no, he said he was going to Cheyenne. So we kept driving and I called California thinking he would call where we left. I guess he had called and got my younger brother, Brian, but Brian took off for the day, you know, went out surfing and wasn't really concerned. He figured that we'd meet up later. David, after he talked to Brian, he started calling my aunt in Massachusetts. So I kept calling California, but Brian was gone, didn't answer the phone till, you know, late that afternoon. When we finally found out that we did, in fact, pass him, my mom and I ended up, we stayed in a hotel, and then the next day, when I still hadn't heard from him all day, and my aunt hadn't heard from him, and my brother in California hadn't heard from him, that's when I was in Nebraska, I went to the police and reported him, you know, be on the lookout, they said they would do, because he was 19, and they weren't really overly concerned. They didn't think too much of it. They're like, well, he probably, you know, your mom's probably right, he probably did go ahead, and it wasn't, you know, illegal for a 19-year-old to take off, so they didn't really consider him a missing person, but they did put the report out. And so we stayed a few days in a hotel hoping to hear from him, never heard anything. Eventually we decided just to drive back to Massachusetts and see if he actually did go all the way back.
Once they made it to Massachusetts and found that David wasn't there, Allison began calling around to see if any of his old friends had seen him.
And I started calling his friends, you know, that he knew. He used to live in Salem, Mass, so that's why he knew people there. None of his friends had heard from him. I called where he used to work. I asked his friends there. You know, none of them had heard from him. Nobody in the family had heard from him. And eventually on the 14th or August 15th, we got a call saying they found the motorcycle. Back then they called them gypsies, but basically they would move their trailers and kind of squat while he did construction jobs. And so this guy, Gail Hallett, was, it's weird because they're both named Gail, him and his wife, Gail and Gail. I guess she found the motorcycle.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Karen went on to explain what they know for sure happened after the last time Allison and their mother had seen David.
What they didn't realize is that somehow David had broken down the side of the road and they didn't see him. They passed him and they didn't see him. My sister was driving and there's no way on earth that if they had ever seen him broken down that they would have just gone by him. I mean, that's just, they would never, ever have done that. And it may not have even been them that David saw. We don't really know what he saw, but he thought he saw the truck go past him on the side of the road. And so he ended up having to walk about 3 miles to the Fort Bridger truck stop to try and find what was wrong with his bike and get a part to fix it. And while he was there, by the way, I'm getting this, you know, this is a story that my aunt told me based on the phone call that David made to her. At this point, once they had all together left that rest area, nobody ever talked to David again except for my aunt. So this is secondhand from her. But basically, David called my aunt and he said, yeah, you know, my bike broke down and pretty sure my mom, you know, passed me on the truck and they didn't see me. And I just pushed my bike 3 miles. And there's a scary looking dude there on a Harley. And he scared me at first, but then he turned out to be a really nice guy and fixed my motorcycle. It's running better than it has run since I got it. And tell my mom and Allison that I'm going to go ahead to Rock Springs and meet them in Rock Springs. And so my mom and Allison, they were trying to call. You know, you got to remember back in the day, no cell phones. People had calling cards, stopping at phone booths, bags of change, stuff like that. So basically what they were doing is either calling to reach my brother Brian in Huntington Beach or my aunt Barbara, my mom's sister in Massachusetts. no one could get hold of my brother, who's out surfing that day. And it wasn't until later in the afternoon that we found out David had called there. The last phone call was to my aunt saying he would go to Rock Springs. So that's when my mom and my sister went, and they stayed there and they waited all night, and there was no David. So the next morning they thought, well, must have just missed him again. Maybe he just, you know, went up ahead to another place. And so they went to the next rest area, and they kind of did that until they finally realized there's something very, very wrong here. And they called in a missing persons report in Lincoln. And this is where kind of some of the jurisdictional hot potato stuff happened, because David was living in California. He had just renewed his driver's license with a California address. So his residence was Huntington Beach. He was reported missing in Lincoln, Nebraska, and he was heading to Massachusetts. And so basically nothing happened with the missing persons report. And you can imagine, you know, police even today are still like, well, you know, he's over 18, he's an adult. It's not a high priority. He's got his license, he's got money. He probably just decided to do something else. Maybe he went back to California, who knows? And so nothing was really done. And it was about 10 days later, and all this time by now, you know, my family was fairly frantic because David never showed up in Massachusetts. He never showed up in California. And the last phone call he ever made was, that we were aware of, was to my Aunt Barbara. And that was on August 5th. So we're really lucky because his motorcycle was reported abandoned 10 days later. Detective Barneski, who was with the Sweetwater County Sheriff's Office, was really on the ball. And she saw this teletype come in about a missing person. And she matched that up with the bike that was reported abandoned. So she connected the two immediately and went and met two deputies at the location of where his motorcycle was found. And when she got there, the camper who had found David's bike reported that the keys were in the ignition. There was half a tank of gas. His books, his backpack, and his motorcycle helmet were all propped against the bike. His wallet was there. Money was there. There was a bag of change, probably, I don't know, $25 maybe in change, a big bag of it. So all of his stuff was there except for David. David just had disappeared off the face of the earth. We know that whatever happened to him, it wasn't robbery, because they didn't take his money. They didn't take the change. They didn't steal the motorcycle. He didn't ride off with anybody else. You know, his helmet was still with the bike. Because they had had a thunderstorm come in a couple of times that weekend, the police said they couldn't process any fingerprints or do anything like that. So Detective Barneski took photos of the scene and of the motorcycle, of the surrounding area, and somehow Sweetwater County Sheriff's Office has lost those photos. The other thing that happened was that somewhere in 2013, when another couple of cold case detectives decided to take a look, they misinterpreted Detective Barneski's instructions. And this is another really confusing part of this whole situation, because there's North Baxter Road, there's Middle Baxter Road, and there's South Baxter Road. And they're not even connected. What Detective Barneski wrote in the police report, she basically wrote that to get to the bike, she was on Airport Road. There's only one Airport Road. If you're driving on I-80 and you get to exit 111, you see a sign that says Baxter Road Airport. It's not called Middle Baxter. It's just called Baxter Road. So when you take exit 111 and you come off of that, then you're taking Airport Road, which is actually officially known as Route 370. Route 370 only goes to one place, and that's the airport, and it dead ends there. There's only one other egress off of 370, and that is Baxter Road or Middle Baxter Road. So she went on 370 Airport Road, then took a right, which is going south on Baxter Road. Kind of redundant on that. She said south on South Baxter. So people have wrongfully assumed a lot of the missing person sites have described that as South Baxter Road, which is actually 17 miles south of where his bike was found. So Middle Baxter Road is the exact name of the street. So she drove down about a mile and a half. And again, this is going back to 1980s, no GPS, no official coordinates. But somewhere around a mile and a half mark, she comes to a dirt road. And according to the police report, the dirt road was on the east side of Middle Baxter Road. And a mile in, heading a mile east towards the airport property, is where David's motorcycle is found on a small draw. That's the closest thing that we have to description. When I spoke with the new person who's running the cold case, Detective Thomas, he gave me these GPS coordinates. And when I looked them up, I realized that the detectives in 2013 went to the wrong place. They were searching in the wrong place. So of course, they found nothing.
When David's motorcycle was found, there was a search conducted of the surrounding area. But Allison explained that the terrain made searching difficult.
There were people that volunteered to ride horseback. There are these washouts, they call it. And so there are these steep ravines. It makes it hard to walk on foot or on any kind of off-road vehicle or anything like that to search the area. So they did what they could. They searched, I guess the people on horseback searched a little bit wider of an area around the motorcycle. They looked on foot for a couple hours, and that was it. You know, and I think they said somebody with a helicopter flew over the area, you know, looking down, trying to see if they could see a red jacket. They didn't see anything, you know, from above, but they said that's not surprising. If he was underneath a bush or something, they would never see his body. I don't think a two-hour search, you know, amounts to much of anything in that kind of an area, that kind of terrain. And I wish that the police had, I think, done more of a search than they did. But, you know, back then, if they didn't even have the, you know, Amber Alert, stuff like that. I don't know if you remember, but no crime against an adult disappearing. You have a right to disappear. That was their attitude. So unless they found a body or something, they really didn't care. And if they didn't find that motorcycle, if the Hallets didn't report the motorcycle, originally it was so hard to find anybody to take the case, they didn't care. I was so frustrated. I was, you know, beside myself. And then, you know, Wyoming had no choice but to take it at the end of the day because of the motorcycle. And that's when they got, you know, they got my aunt's phone bill and got the phone number and looked it up and did verify that it was where David said he was. It was, in fact, at a payphone. I think it was called the bingo truck stop back then. My father flew out there, jumped on the bike, started right up, drove it all the way back to California, never had a problem, never broke down. They let my father take it and drive it home.
Allison remembers something that the couple who found the bike said to the police that caught her attention.
I remember Detective Barneski saying right away she suspected foul play, but she didn't say why, really. I guess that's just the sense that she got. I don't know if David drove the motorcycle there. I don't know if someone else drove it there. That Hallett guy, Mr. Hallett, said he remembered on Thursday, so let's see, what's Monday was the 5th, 6th, 7th, so somewhere around the 8th or the 9th, he saw somebody with long hair driving a turquoise and chrome motorcycle, and it had either a bedroll or luggage on the back, drive out of that road where David's motorcycle was found. But nobody saw anyone go in, and they only saw one person go out. So I don't know if that guy's related or if it was just a, you know, coincidence or what.
Karen also notes that due to a lack of evidence, resources in 1985, and detectives searching in the wrong areas, there's also discrepancies in David's description in his missing persons file.
My sister Allison and I feel pretty strongly that the description of David's clothing is wrong, that he never wore anything but Levi 501. I mean, that was all he ever wore for his entire life, like the time he first started wearing them when he was, you know, maybe in middle school. And so we feel that there's a strong possibility that he wasn't wearing brown pants, that he had 501, you know, jeans on. And his hair is described as brown, and it really wasn't. It's kind of a sandy, dark blonde. It's not really brown, and it's kind of wavy. So there's a couple of things that are kind of wrong in the, you know, missing persons report. That's basically where we're at. In my own research, in looking for other things that might be connected, some kind of explanation about this, you know, like I found that there were three other bodies that were found off of dirt roads off of I-80. And that was something, you know, I didn't know there were two men that were found and one woman who was connected to another murder. So it's, you know, unlikely that they're all connected, but I just thought it was still kind of weird that they all were found right off of I-80 on these dirt roads that really you'd have to know the area very well in order to have found this road where the motorcycle was.
Karen, just like the rest of her family, has been trying to make sense of the little information she has regarding August 5th, and where David could have gone or why his motorcycle was found in such an isolated area.
I just can't understand why he would go down that dirt road on his own, unless he was tired of waiting at the rest area and was just, you know, wanted to do something else or was waiting to make a phone call. But one of the things my sister and I believe is that there's something about the guy that fixed his bike, and that maybe that guy said, I'm heading that way, you know, let's go with you. One of the things that has never been reported until recently is that my cousin, my Aunt Barbara's son, my cousin Richard, years after David's disappearance said, oh, you know, David actually called me that day and said he was in Rock Springs and that he was going to grab a beer and then go wait at the rest area. And the thing that was odd about that is that my brother didn't drink. He still had, you know, he has like extensive scarring. You know, he's kind of a fragile kid. He couldn't do sport or, you know, get in fights or anything like that. You know, a punch to the stomach could kill him, could be lethal. And he just couldn't drink. I mean, the one time that he tried, and I think it's, you know, because of his kidneys not being able to work properly, you know, at full capacity, but he never drank. He liked smoking pot, which, of course, you know, was fairly common with kids in California back in the 80s, but definitely wouldn't have been on a cross-country trip. So he didn't have anything with him. He would have been, I think, terrified of getting stopped someplace with, you know, pot on him by a cop. However, if he did run into someone and they said, hey, do you want to go smoke a joint or something? He may have gone with them to do that. That's possible. Is it possible that he found out all of a sudden in Wyoming the drinking age was 18 and who could actually walk in a bar? That might have been exciting to him, too. If he went into some kind of bar in Rock Springs, that was a really scary place in 1985. There was a lot of crime. There was a lot of drug trafficking, human trafficking, you know, all kinds of really sketch stuff, corrupt police force. So it wasn't really a good place. And David was incredibly naive. If he walked into some kind of a bar, he might as well have a big sign over his head saying, you know, I'm a mark. He just wasn't, you know, that street smart. He was really naive and, like I said, you know, really introverted. And it wouldn't be like him to go to a bar alone. I can't even imagine him doing that. But if he had this guy with him, maybe he would have. So really, the problem is the police did find out that David, in fact, made that call at the Bingo truck stop, called the Bingo truck stop back then in Fort Bridger. They did find that evidence, but they never found the guy. So the last call that we knew of was one that David made to my aunt in Fort Bridger at the truck stop there. And I think it's now a Flying J, but at the time it was the Bingo truck stop. And so that's where he said, I'm in Fort Bridger and I'm going to go to Rock Springs to meet my mom and sister. If you hear from them, tell them to wait there for me. And that was where he was going. And so Rock Springs would have been the halfway point. If he got gas in Fort Bridger and drove to Rock Springs, he would have used up a half tank of gas. And that's exactly where his motorcycle was registering. So the police were able to determine, they got from the phone company records of that phone booth, and they did discover that my brother used that phone booth to call my Aunt Barbara. So they have proof of that. And that's the last proof that we have of him ever talking to anybody in the family was in Fort Bridger. And then his bike was found in Rock Springs. So we believe whatever happened to him in Rock Springs. He just disappeared off the face of the earth. No one ever used his social security number. His driver's license came in the mail a couple of weeks afterwards. And so there was no track of him. Police went to the airport. They checked all the flights out. He hadn't taken any flight anywhere. And, you know, none of his friends ever heard from him again. None of his good friends, either in California or Massachusetts, and no family member. And he was close to us. He's not one of those kids that would have just disappeared. So that's why, you know, we really feel that the clue to solving this is going to be with someone in Rock Springs, that maybe somebody remembered seeing him. You know, he was 6'4", 6'5", he's a tall kid, tall, skinny kid, and he kind of would have stuck out. And if, you know, maybe someone remembers him from back then, you know, unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of questioning being done at the time. I'm not really sure what Detective Barneski did, but it, it's not in her report that she went and interviewed anyone or tried to find the guy at the Fort Bridger truck stop. So we also know that it was a couple of weeks of that motorcycle rally in Sturgis. And so there are a lot of motorcycles going through. Either David wandered off on the bike, in which case he couldn't have been planning on going far because he wouldn't have left the keys in the bike and all of his stuff there, including his money, his wallet and everything. So his wallet was in his backpack. So that's where all of his stuff was in his backpack. It just doesn't seem like, you know, if you're going to wander off and do something, why wouldn't you put your keys in your pocket and take your wallet with you? It's kind of like whatever happened to him, happened to him and either someone left his bike there. But even that doesn't make sense because his stuff was outside leaning up against the motorcycle. And what we're trying to find out is that the way it was found when the campers found it? Or did the guy who found the bike take that stuff out and lean it there? So we don't know if that was something David did or if that was something another person did. If in fact someone else found the bike and pulled stuff out looking through it. But again, back then there was a lot of money in his wallet. He had a big bag of change and all of that stuff was there. So robbery would not have been the motive to hurt him. If someone hurt him, if someone did something to him, it would not, you know, robbery would not have been the cause.
In the 35 years that have passed since David went missing, not much has moved within the case. All that his loved ones are left with are questions.
I've made up probably 1,000 stories about what happened to him. I guess it depends if you think he drove the bike there or not. I think if he drove his motorcycle there, because he had spent the night on the side of the road and knowing how cold I was, I think he was cold and didn't sleep. So I think if he went off the road, he probably just stopped and figured he'd rest a while. I'm thinking he called, was, you know, trying to reach out and didn't get my aunt on the phone. So I think he just stopped, took a break. I don't know. I'm guessing maybe he fell asleep. Maybe he woke up in the middle of the night when it started to get cold, either couldn't find his way back to the bike or tripped and fell with all the washouts and stuff there. The detectives have more nefarious thoughts. They're like, well, you know, if that motorcycle that they saw leave, you know, they could have been assaulting him for days. And I'm like, oh, I don't really want to think about that. Why they jumped to that, I don't know. That wasn't this latest detective. That was like two detectives ago had that theory. If he had stopped in downtown Rock Springs and someone heard his story, you know, maybe they figured he had money because he was traveling cross country. But, you know, it would have had to be two people that rode the motorcycle there, right? If you're going to rob somebody, are you going to really leave their motorcycle? Just doesn't add up. But the other weird thing is, I was trying to figure out if David did drive the motorcycle down that road, how the hell did he find it? Because it's not an easy, you know, pull off the exit of the highway and see it. You know, it's kind of off the beaten track. So then I was wondering about the motorcycle that had the bedroll. It's like, it seemed to me like a local would know about the area, not somebody from out of town. I don't know. I know there were tons of, you know, drugs and things like that going on in Rock Springs in the 80s.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. As Karen briefly mentioned earlier, she's wondered if her brother's case could be connected to other cases in the area.
Every lead that I've tracked down for serial killers that, you know, there are a lot of truck driver serial killers and stuff, but I haven't been able to chase down any information that would be helpful to police on my own. Like I said, there were two male John Does. One was Coltrane Carl and the other one was Pipeline Pete. And they were found in, their remains were found in 1982 and 1988, and David's bike was found in 1985. All were in August. And those other two guys have not been identified. Pipeline Pete, his nude body was found, again, off a dirt road. And then there was this woman that they call her Betty, who was found at the Rock Springs rest area where my mom and my sister are waiting for David. And she's been linked through DNA to another murder that was up north. So I plotted those things in a map because you just never know what, I mean, like I submitted my DNA to the open source database that law enforcement can use in the hopes that if anything is ever found of David, they'll be able to track down a relative. I've done that. And I know that some of those people that do the DNA stuff are really amazing. They've solved a lot of stuff. Unfortunately for us, we don't have a body to work off. You know, we don't have any kind of clues like that.
We asked Allison what she believes happened to David.
My sister Karen is kind of trying to piece together like serial killers and where they were and things like that, but I don't think it's that complicated. I think he's still there. I think something happened to him. I think he drove down that road. I don't know, was sitting on the bike and then, you know, decided to walk up the hill and watch the planes land or something. And I don't know, tripped, fell. Whatever. They said if he had fallen in one of those washouts, they wouldn't have seen him because there are shrubs and things like that that grow after the water recedes, after the, you know, the spring melt. It's just all vegetation and dry. Then they were like, plus, you know, coyotes and things like that, they would have, you know, some animal would have dragged his body off. And all the things they talk about aren't too pleasant to think about. I don't think he ever left Wyoming. I don't know, you know, if someone befriended him and took him down that dirt road, you know, that was a local. If they did, then they weren't seen unless it was that guy that left, you know, like on Thursday that Hallett said he saw leaving Thursday night. But that would mean they were out there, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I don't know. I'm guessing too that the bikes were there Monday. Maybe it wasn't, you know, maybe the guy, you know, befriended him somewhere and said, hey, why don't you hang out at my place for a few days or, you know, till you get in touch with your parent, your mom or whatever. Who knows? And then something happened. But, you know, somebody drove the motorcycle there and somebody carefully placed the knapsack against the outside. Definitely not somebody that was looking for money, because there's no way you would leave an expensive motorcycle like that with the keys and everything. I guess that's why that other detective was so dark and gloomy, telling me about, you know, what horrible things people do to other people. I keep going back to the simplest thing, like, you know, he called, he didn't get my aunt, you know, let's say he got my cousin Richard, and Richard's like, oh, I don't know where my mom went, but, you know, she'll call back later, bye. So now he's like frustrated, he's tired, you know, I'm sure he didn't sleep on the side of the road very well, and, you know, it's getting late in the afternoon, so maybe he did just decide to pull down that dirt road and hang out.
David's family has spent decades trying to figure out what could have happened to him. Karen told us what she thinks happened.
It's extremely unlikely someone would have been stalking him and disabled his bike or whatever. You know, we would love to be able to talk to the guy that fixed his bike and say, hey, you know, did he say where he was going? Did he mention anything to you? Did that guy go with him to Rock Springs and, you know, take him to a bar? Did he say, hey, let's go smoke a joint? And who knows? But Allison is, because she was on that trip and she remembers so vividly a lot of the things that happened. She's haunted. She's absolutely haunted. She and David were incredibly close when they were growing up. They, like I said, they were only a year apart, and so many hundreds of childhood photos are of the two of them together. They were more like twins, and they were so close. And I know it just kills her. She's really tormented, remembering the last time that she saw him and just wondering what happened to him. And I don't think she'll have peace in her life until she finds out. Really, it's amazing how, even after decades, some little clue will materialize, or somebody will say, oh, you know, I didn't realize I saw that, but now I remember. And it's just, we didn't have the kind of communication that we do now. That was non-existent in 1985. You know, even if there was a newspaper article written in Huntington Beach or in Massachusetts or even in Rock Springs, there's no guarantee that anybody would have seen, you know, one story about a missing kid. You just didn't have the kind of saturation and the kind of reach that, you know, that we have now with social media. We're thinking, well, you know, maybe someone could read that and it will jog their memory, or they'll say, yeah, you know, I worked in a motorcycle store. I remember that dude. Or someone might say, they might remember that road. And I think, you know, one of the things that really upset my sister when she called a few years ago is whatever cold case detective she talked to a few years ago said to her, you know, you're going to find his body out there in the desert. It's probably, someone probably sexually assaulted him and killed him and left him out there. And my sister is sort of horrified that that was how someone would talk to a family member. And so that's kind of, you know, where we're at. It's distressing to find out that, according to Detective Tomich, there's almost nothing in David's file. And the very fact that the photographs aren't even there, the photographs went missing, they don't have the exact GPS coordinates. We've tried going on just like, you know, a white page background search to try and find Detective Barneski, and tried reaching out to family members on Facebook. We tried reaching out to the people who are camping in the location that found David's motorcycle. You know, we just really need some leads like that. We could find maybe those kids that weren't there, because it was this woman, and basically there was a family living there, you know, husband, wife, and a couple of kids. And they went to Big Piney on the weekend, and they were camping there during the week.
With the 35th anniversary of David's disappearance coming up later this year, his sisters are hoping to organize a new search for their brother.
Our goal is that what Allison and I want to do on the 35th anniversary next August is go out and search the area again and see if we can get some volunteers to come out with us and help us search and see if we can find something. Maybe find out what happened to him, find his remains, bring him home, and see if we can find any kind of clue or any information. So we're hoping that somewhere, you know, some resident will pop up and remember something. You know, I know it was a long time ago, but that's really about the only hope that we have at this point.
So what happened to David Lovely back in August of 1985? Even after all these years, David's disappearance remains a mystery to this day. Considering the technology that we have today, it's strange to think back to 1985 and realize how easy it would be to lose track of someone on the road like that and have no way to get in contact with them. We know that the last time anyone heard from David was when he called from the Bingo truck stop. He spoke to his aunt and told her about the man who helped him fix his bike. He said that he would continue on to Rock Springs, where his mom and sister were waiting for him. That's when David disappeared. It should have taken him a little over an hour to get from the truck stop to Rock Springs, but as far as we know, he never made it. The strange thing is that his bike was found in such a remote area off of the highway just south of Rock Springs. it's hard to make sense of why he would have been at that location. Is this the case of David crossing paths with the wrong person and met a tragic end? Or was David in some kind of unfortunate accident and has yet to be discovered? Did he leave his bike there on his own, or was it planted there by someone to throw off the search for him? Whatever the truth is, the most important piece of the puzzle is still missing, David himself. At the time of his disappearance, David was 19 years old. He was approximately 6'4" to 6'5" tall and weighed around 160 pounds. He had blue eyes and dirty blonde hair. One distinguishing feature is that David had a large surgical scar on his abdomen right below his rib cage. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of David Lovely, please call the Sweetwater County Sheriff's Department at 307-872-6350. You may also call the Wyoming Division of Criminal Investigation at 307-777-7181. Or the Huntington Beach Police Department at 714-536-5641.
I spend a lot of time looking at the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And, you know, I go through the NAMIS database all the time. I go through the missing persons. And, you know, obviously I'm looking for clues for my brother. But I also look to see, every time I look at one of those facial reconstructions, and I think, you know, they belong to somebody. Just to be able to reunite them with their family would be, somebody loves them, someone somewhere cares about them. You know, my heart breaks every time I look through those, and I think that, you know, obviously the impetus for a lot of people is just they do care, and those people are lost. I can almost hear their cries, you know, when I go through the database and I look through all of these people, and just, I think, okay, I'm looking for the remains, but somewhere there are remains that are looking for the family. And if you can somehow connect the two, just to give people closure. And they are, there's so many, and the victims really deserve to have their stories told. A lot of times we think about the criminals and the victims, who they were, their families, and who the personalities, and what did they like, and who were they? A lot of times we lose track of the fact that these are people, these are human beings, and they had lives, and they were loved, and they were liked, and they made people laugh, and, you know, they were good friends, and they deserve to be remembered.
That brings us to the end of episode 211. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Georgia. Thanks for listening.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart-Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.